print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradiobreathing.org.
Hello, this is Bruce, and for the next hour I'll be reading from the August 20th, 2026 issue of the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. One of the top stories, what's the condition of Niagara Falls system for wastewater? Works GM says large project can be supported. Article by Ray Spiteri. Can Niagara Falls underground infrastructure handle large developments? The question has gained new relevance following massive rainstorms this summer that resulted in basement flooding, sewage backups, and states of emergency being declared in parts of the region. Niagara Falls has been planning how to handle major development applications that come forward, such as the $757.3 million mixed-use project anticipated to bring 1,782 purpose-built rental units to Dorchester Road, says the city's general manager of municipal works. Most recently, we've developed a master servicing plan, which has several years of studying our water, wastewater, and stormwater systems to look at a 2051 growth plan, said Eric Nickel. By doing those studies, we've anticipated not just the impacts of one development at a time, but the cumulative impacts of all these developments within that 25-year timeline. He said what the municipality can't control is the pace. Therefore, we take those long-term plans, and when these developments come through the planning process, which is zoning, bylaw amendments, official plan amendments, what we know is that the land is being prepared and that the land is suitable to have this type of density within it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the infrastructure has been improved at the same time that the zoning has been approved. Nickel said before a site plan agreement is signed, development applicants are required to demonstrate that their sites will not negatively impact the infrastructure meant to service it. If they need to upgrade sewers in the local area, if they need to upgrade pump stations, if they need to upgrade traffic signals at turning lanes, all those things are demonstrated through the studies that we require them to submit, he said. And they will need to either pay the development charges that will accommodate those things, if they're bigger and broader improvements, or if they're specifically related to their development. They may need to complete themselves or fund the city or Niagara region on a cost-sharing type of basis for those more immediate improvements. During last week's meeting, City Council backed official plan and zoning bylaw amendments requested by Angelo Butera so that his Panoramic Properties Company can develop a massive project on 7.1 hectares of vacant land at 5259 Dorchester Road. His plans call for two mixed-use buildings, one commercial building, and four apartment dwellings with heights of 5 to 25 stories, along with many storage and maintenance buildings. Dozens of residents in the area attend neighborhood meetings and submitted correspondence to the city about the project, many with concerns related to the scale of the development and how it could impact issues such as traffic and infrastructure. One resident during last week's council meeting brought up flooding from recent storms and wondered how the development could affect the area's water and sewer systems. In an interview, Nichols said the local infrastructure generally is not going to be impaired by the addition of these new units. But we know that there is a bottleneck at some of the regional infrastructure, the pumping stations and the force main that surround this area and that service it, he said. That has been made known to the developer, and they know that in order to get clearance of those conditions for approval and to get to the approval of a site plan stage, they need to satisfy the region that there's sufficient upgrades to the system so that flow can be conveyed to the wastewater treatment plant. While Nichols said the city does have an aging infrastructure system, Only 15% of its sanitary sewers remain combined with the stormwater system. He said the city has been working on investing significantly on sewer separation projects. Despite that, data from Niagara Region indicates sewage bypass situations are a significant problem in Niagara Falls. In 2025, the total number of overflows or bypasses at Niagara Falls sites was 83, with a total volume of partially treated outflows at 211.683 milliliters. That was an improvement over 2024, when 106 overflow incidents occurred, with a volume of 486.51 ml. 1 ml, or megaliter, equals 1 million liters. Treatment facility bypasses occur when large volumes of liquid, most commonly caused by heavy rain, threaten to back up the sewer system into homes. Niagara Region is currently planning to replace the Niagara Falls sewage treatment plant at a cost of $688 million, the largest infrastructure project in the region municipality's history. "We have a system that is influenced by wet weather and significant weather events," said Nickel. "We know that in a severe wet weather situation, our wastewater infrastructure is conveying a lot of infiltration and inflow. It's basically conveying a lot of rainwater, groundwater, through the sanitary sewers due to the variety of reasons. Old infrastructure, cracks, leaks in pipes, and areas that are not yet separated. So we're actually collecting that stormwater and sending it to the sanitary sewer, which we call then a combined sewer. We're doing a lot of work in the city to try to take away the stormwater from our sewer system and free that system up to allow actual sewage to come in for new developments." Nickel said new developments are not contributing as much to sanitary systems as would a system that has all the infiltration and inflow coming into it. He said not all 1,800 units will be flushing toilets at the same time, which would otherwise inundate the system. "But think about the amounts of rainfall, like 1 inch of rainfall, which is 25 millimeters, and we received upwards of 100 millimeters in recent storms. So 4 inches of rainfall, if that all falls on one roof, that's the equivalent of 10 toilets, at least all draining to the same pipe," said Nickel. "When you look at the scale of the water that's coming into our system from a combined system, it is 10 times the amount of flow that's coming in from a separated system and a brand new system. I don't think it's fair for the city to take a freeze or a pause on development, because it's not the development that's causing these problems. They exist here today, and they're very minimally contributing or adding to a problem that we know is already a situation that we're working on and that we're trying to tackle." He said some new approved developments are paying millions of dollars in development charges that are spent to improve the system for those existing residents who might be suffering. "We can use those development charges to pay and to mine additional capacity in the system and to separate the system. Without their contribution from new development, we're left with only our water rates and sewer rates, which no one wants to see climb to tackle some of these major infrastructure challenges," said Nickel. "I think the important part of that new Dorchester Road development is that the city and the region are working together. We're both doing master planning. We know that there's infrastructure upgrades that are due, and we're coming and we're working on those." Will Conservation Authority changes mean more floods? As Niagara Peninsula and Hamilton authorities prepare to fold into a single regional body by February of 2027, officials say core flood work stays local. Article by Laura Seben. As Niagara continues to dry out from record-breaking rainfall earlier this month that left hundreds of people with flooded basements and homes, the province is pressing forward with its plans to amalgamate the existing conservation authorities from 36 down to 9. "It's something that's raising concerns among residents who are aware of the important role conservation authorities play when it comes to flood mitigation." The plan to consolidate the groups was put into action by Doug Ford's Tory government earlier this year, with a transition expected to happen by the target date of February 1st, 2027. Agency currently serving the Hamilton area include the Hamilton Conservation Authority, HCA, and the Niagara Peninsula Conservation Authority, NPCA. They will both become part of the new Western Lake Ontario Regional Conservation Authority, joining the Halton and Credit Valley agencies. The province said amalgamation will help get shovels in the ground faster for needed housing and infrastructure projects because policies, standards, and fees would no longer vary across authorities. However, in light of devastating flooding seen in the Niagara, Binbrook, and Upper Stony Creek regions in the last several weeks, could amalgamation hinder the environmental organizations' ability to manage their respective watersheds? The challenge is that we're still trying to determine what it all means, Jonathan Bastine, Water Resources Engineering Manager at the HCA, said in an interview with The Spectator. There could be some positive opportunities, and we're going to be more tied into each other. Will we be more communicative? If there's a storm coming from the Niagara area, will we know about it quicker because our counterparts in Niagara are now in the same system as us and we're sharing information in real time? All of that is still something we don't know. A spokesman from the NPCA agreed that it would be premature to speculate on any operational impacts of amalgamation since the transition has yet to be completed. What we can say is that flood forecasting, natural hazard management, and watershed-based planning remain fundamental conservation authority responsibilities, the spokesperson said. Conservation authorities are typically the front line when it comes to flood management. They do this by monitoring watershed conditions, forecasting potential flooding, maintaining and updating floodplain mapping, and regulating development in and near natural hazard areas. That information is then provided to municipalities and emergency responders so they can activate their own procedures and take appropriate action, according to the NPCA. It is then municipalities who are responsible for maintenance of local stormwater and drainage infrastructure, including drains, ditches, and culverts. The progressive conservative government is promising that amalgamation will not affect the role these authorities play when it comes to watershed management and flood prevention. In a statement to The Spectator, a spokesperson for the Ministry of the Environment, Conservation and Parks, MECP, said the amalgamation plan will ensure more resources can be directed to frontline work and better equip conservation authorities to deliver on their mandate of protecting communities from natural events, including flooding. The mandates of conservation authorities will remain unchanged, and they will continue to provide the same programs and services as they do today, the statement continued. The MECP said the agencies will also remain municipally governed and that local offices will stay open. From a flood forecasting perspective, each conservation authority has built up a wealth of experience and understanding of their watershed and how it reacts to storms of different intensities, Bastine explained. They know where the problem areas could be and what to expect, but you can't really transition that knowledge to other watersheds without a lot of time and training. Bastine said it's for that reason he expects things will remain quite localized, even once amalgamated. Laura Sieben is a reporter at the Hamilton Spectator. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The intensity and frequency of extreme weather to grow, according to expert. Article by Mark Newman. St. Catharines and Lincoln declared states of emergency after the August 2nd storm, and a McMaster climate scientist warned Southern Ontario residents could see more intense rainfall in future. Going forward, there will be more increases in the intensity and the frequency of extreme weather events, and the rainfall and the flooding is the primary extreme event, said McMaster University professor Altaf Aryan. It can happen anywhere at any location. If you look at the past 5 years or more, we've had this torrential rain almost in every city. Aryan, who is the founding director of the McMaster Center for Climate Change, said he bases his conclusions on a 2023 report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, a body of the United Nations. He said it has been well established that climate change is behind the torrential rains and other extreme weather conditions, like heat waves and droughts. As climate change is warming the air, it means the atmosphere can hold much more water, he said. When air rises up, clouds are formed, and the condensation happens, and all this water has to come down because the air cannot hold that water anymore. Living near the Great Lakes also poses an additional risk. Aryan said storm systems rolling through southern Ontario also pick up moisture from the lakes that adds to the rainfall. If you are living near a water body, then coastal areas will be more vulnerable to flooding, he said. It means there is an unlimited supply of water available to the atmosphere. Infrastructure and local flood warning systems will need upgrading to handle what's ahead, Aryan said. Aryan said carbon emissions are the root cause of climate change. The only way to slow down or mitigate it would be for the governments around the world and the public to reduce those emissions and work to cap the global increase in temperature to 1.5 Celsius by the end of the century. Why is a 533-year-old Polish astronomer on a local street sign? Copernicus Way sign now installed in St. Catherine's neighborhood. Article by Karina Walter. When the local Polish community wanted to mark the 550th anniversary in 2023 of astronomer Nicholas Copernicus's birth, they had a down-to-earth request. They asked St. Catherine's to approve an honorary street name for the Polish Renaissance thinker. There was just one problem. The city didn't have a process for accepting honorary street names. Several reports, multiple council meetings, and a newly written and adopted policy later, honorary signs for Copernicus Way were installed in late July on a section of Facer Street. It took 3 years, but better late than never, right? Said Sophia Soja, president of the Canadian Polish Congress Niagara District. Copernicus Way is the first honorary street name under the city's new policy, which doesn't change the legally established name of a road, but is a symbolic gesture. An honorary name accompanies the actual street sign to mark an individual, event, place, or organization. Who was he? Copernicus paved the way for modern astronomy with his heliocentric theory that planets orbit the sun and the universe was larger than had been previously believed. His theory and impact are a profound source of pride for the people of Polish descent in St. Catharines and around the world. There is a saying that he stopped the sun and moved the earth, Sonja said. We are proud that he was our ancestor. The government in Poland declared 2023 the year of Copernicus to mark the 550th anniversary of his birth, and Polish communities around the world marked the date. The Canadian Polish Congress celebrated that year with meetings and lectures about the life of Copernicus, a traveling exhibition about his impact in the naming of streets, parks, or other landmarks. Soja said in St. Catharines, the most appropriate location to honor Copernicus was on Facer Street. The neighborhood is home to Polish businesses and many families who settled in the area after they emigrated from Poland after the First and Second World Wars. The Niagara chapter requested the honorary street name in the area in 2023. That began an exercise in patience. No policy, no sign. Council asked staff to prepare a report on the request. The resulting report in November of 2024 said the city had naming policies in place for streets and parks, but didn't have a policy for processing honorary street name requests. Council directed staff to prepare an honorary street naming policy. A draft policy was approved by council in December of 2025. With that policy in place, the Polish Society's request could then be considered. In a letter to council, Soja wrote, "Copernicus is Poland's most important single contribution to human civilization and is important to the Polish community, which has deep roots and long-established history in the city." She said Copernicus could be celebrated because he was a man who was intellectually fearless and started a scientific revolution based on unchanging principles, rigorous observation, and mathematical proof. He changed humanity's understanding of the universe and opened the path to modern science, which was followed by great scientists like Galileo, Newton, and others, she wrote. By honoring Copernicus, St. Catherine's would be essentially honoring the path of modern science and discovery and identifying itself as a science-aware city. The new policy. In May of 2026, council approved the honorary street name Copernicus Way for a portion of Facer Street as recommended by staff. The Polish Congress then had to pay to have the signs made, and they were installed by the city last month for the section of Facer Street between Curie Street and Ormond Avenue. Soja said it took some time, but she is grateful to City Council for making it happen. The Polish Congress is holding a celebratory unveiling at the corner of Facer Street and Ormond Avenue at 11:30 a.m. this Sunday. Under the city's new honorary street naming policy, proposed names must be related to an individual, organization, or event that aligns with the city's corporate values, the province, or Canada. The contribution or significance of the name must be documented and verifiable. Preference will be given to applications that honor an individual, organization, or event that has local significance. The city will also prioritize names significant to Indigenous peoples, Black communities, and equity-deserving groups, and give consideration to celebrating untold stories that are not currently represented in the city's public spaces. Has Trudeau forgotten Canada? Article by Vinay Menon, Toronto Star Entertainment columnist. Justin Trudeau haunts us still. This time he is doing so from inside a Home Hardware in Montreal. Life after public office is a choose-your-own-adventure. Some politicos retreat from the spotlight. Others make a fortune on the speaker's circuit. Some sit on boards. Others remain policy wonks, boring family and friends with abstract ideas about how to make the world a better place. Justin Trudeau has chosen to dance with a toilet plunger. Whatever you think of our former PM, and he remains as polarizing as pineapple on pizza, the man is a publicity hound, getting attention in his Nepo baby blood. He was seen at a Home Hardware on St. Laurent on the weekend. Girlfriend Katy Perry filmed him busting out the dad moves as his son Zav's new R&B song came over the store speaker. The clip was allegedly of a proud papa spontaneously gyrating with joy as his 18-year-old son's song unexpectedly played on the radio, right? This was PR stunt, Justin. Perry is filming before Trudeau enters the frame while hoisting a plunger and tray of DIY sundries. Is she psychic? How did she know Virgin Radio was about to play downtown? I'm also confused as to why Trudeau continues to inflict retinal harm on us by dancing. He has the rhythm of an irregular heartbeat. Is he bopping to a catchy tune or getting subdued by a taser? It's not clear. Here's what I do get. Why isn't Trudeau using his PR instincts to help Canada? Oh, here's what I don't get. Why isn't Trudeau using his PR instincts to help Canada? As this great nation is forced to negotiate with Tariff Man in the White House, couldn't Trudeau at least film one PSA to help prevent the closure of a Stellantis plant? Yes, he is now a private citizen. Yes, he can gorge on fast food at Coachella or take a glitzy summer Euro tour with his superstar babe. But he also has Canada for nearly a decade. He also led Canada for nearly a decade. It would be nice if he took a break from juggling Timbits and a backward baseball cap to fight back forcefully as Tariff Man threatens a 50% levy on everything from our exports of dairy to hockey sticks. Speak up, dude. Say something. His fluency in optics and social media could be useful right now. The other living former PMs do not possess Trudeau's natural sense of new media. Stephen Harper donning a cowboy hat and riding a mechanical bull while extolling the virtues of free trade is not going to electrify Generation Z. Kim Campbell is a great ambassador for many causes, but she is to TikTok as a rotary phone is to live stream. Trudeau left office and is now a superhero in the Katy Perry cinematic universe. Good for him. But there should be some ROI for Canadian taxpayers who funded his mastery of publicity. We gave him the runway. We were the ones who footed the bill for his socks diplomacy. We paid the internet's boyfriend to photobomb weddings and jog past prom grads. During a state visit to India, we financed his preposterous Bollywood costume changes while praying he didn't show up for a bilateral meeting in brownface. Is there no way for PM Trudeau and stunt Justin to morph into one person as Canada stares into the abyss of an escalating trade war? Can't he still make out with Katie in Santa Barbara while finding time to help his country that is locked in mortal combat with Tariff Man? Why can't he blend old statecraft with new stagecraft? Nobody is suggesting Trudeau be the anti-venom for poisonous current affairs. Mark Carney is our leader. He must negotiate trade and navigate the necrotizing fissures, as America, once our staunch ally, treats us the way Angelina Jolie would react to Brad Pitt during a chance encounter at Trader Joe's. Tariff Man wanted to rule us. Now he wants to destroy us. Justin Trudeau should put down the plunger and say something. Deal with Alberta is deeply disturbing. Article by Susan Caswan. She is a freelance contributing columnist for the Waterloo Region Record. In the last few weeks, Niagara Region declared a state of emergency from devastating back-to-back superstorms. This was shortly followed by another in Southwold, south of London, and then Kitchener that required evacuation of everyone from the annual Blues Festival. The personal impact of having to clean up flooded homes and streets and prevent further damage and mold and do the necessary repairs is life-altering. The University of Waterloo's Intact Center on Climate Change Adaptation has multiple reports and resources on the emotional, physical, and financial toll of monster storms and flooding. The 2018 report, After the Flood, The Impact of Climate Change on Mental Health and Lost Time from Work, surveyed people who experienced the flooding compared to others in the vicinity and found flooded households experienced significantly higher worry and stress. That worry was still felt 3 years later when it rained. The average time off work after flooding was 7 days. The Insurance Bureau of Canada reported insured damage caused by severe weather events surpassed $8 billion in 2024, and that Ontario and Quebec ice storm in 2025 caused $466 million in insured damage. Equally devastating is the loss of life, wildlife, forest cover, and homes, and the Continued widespread of smoke from anthropogenic climate change wildfires. A Lancet paper reports that globally 1.5 million all-cause deaths per year were attributable to LFS landscape fire-sourced air pollution during 2019. A study published in Nature in 2025 found climate change has driven the observed increase in frequency and intensity of wildfires, which produce substantial amounts of fine particulate matter. Wildfire PM, exposure to PM, is known to cause of mortality and cardiovascular disease, and is linked to onset and worsening of respiratory conditions. Ongoing trends of increasing wildfire severity align with climate projections and underscore how climate change factors such as easier snow melt, intensified heat waves, and rising vapor pressure deficit have already expanded forest fire extent, accelerated daily fire growth rates, and enabled more extreme fire events. Like many others, I am deeply disturbed that our federal government has a Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, with the Alberta government to build a $35.2 billion plus oil pipeline. Canadian unity cannot be based on appeasing climate-destroying fossil fuel advocates, especially when the International Energy Agency and World Economic Forum report that clean renewables, especially solar, have been the cheapest form of electricity since 2020. The prospect of another pipeline is terrifying, and the courts are feeling like the last refuge to hold our governments to account. In Ontario, despite the Ford government's repeal of Ontario's climate law and emissions target, the Ontario Court of Appeal recently granted the youth-led case represented by EcoJustice to return to the Ontario Supreme Court of Justice. Another case is proceeding against the federal government for essentially the same goal. I would encourage everyone to sign petition E7522 to the Government of Canada before it closes September 14th to voice your opposition to the MOU as the final nail in the coffin for Canada's climate policy. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Tackling Wildfires Without Retching. Article by William Thomas. He is a Niagara-based humor columnist. 4 decades ago, I spent 10 days in the middle of Montana writing features for a wonderful American publication titled Skier's Almanac. Sadly, Buffalo entrepreneur Tom Leeds' brilliant Bible on North American ski hills died shortly after the publication's birth. That 80s Montana has survived to this day, if only in my mind. I was charmed by its earthly Stetson-topped people, humbled by its towering glacial peaks, and dazed by its rugged snow-capped beauty. Roads were mere irritants that interrupted the wilderness. Rivers were everywhere you turned, their depth clear to the naked eye. Then Montana was still the Wild West, with honest-to-goodness cowboys who talked low, who lived high and hard, and who did not cuss around women. There were cattle ranchers, cow punchers, and people with names like Smoke Elser and Whispering Smith. Back then, Montana was a glorious place to live for frontier people, a hard and heartless place to make an honest living. The copper mines had all closed, and the markets for cattle and lumber were shrinking fast. Everyone I met was working 2 or 3 jobs, and those who didn't soon moved on. I asked an old cowboy at the Oxford Cafe and Saloon why he stayed in such a tough town. He rubbed his chin in deep thought and said, "Never made enough money to move out." That's what I remember most about Montanans, their folksy sense of humor, and their penchant for jumping out of planes into the middle of forest fires. Seeking good publicity, the local tourist office gave me the full treatment. Hiking, fly fishing, horse riding in the foothills, and skiing high above them, of course. They also got me a seat on a Twin Otter training flight with 7 members of the Missoula Smoke Jumpers, young and extremely fit firefighters who parachuted out of planes to fight remote and mountainous wildfires that were inaccessible by road. Within 10 minutes of the forest fire alarm, these guys were in the air and headed for hell and scorched death, with drop boxes of food, water, and equipment already loaded in the hold. On this particular training mission, I was just along for the ride, sitting silently in the back of the plane. Nearing the drop zone, a smoke jumper 2 rows ahead of me suddenly lurched, grabbed his helmet, and retched. He passed the helmet back to the guy behind him, who also jolted, gagged, and vomited into the same helmet. I had no choice but to accept the helmet, which was now half full of puke, and quickly passed it to the guy next to me. For the record, I did not vomit, as they thought I would, which later earned me an ovation from all the smoke jumpers on board. I was the rookie. This was their hazing prank. The helmet had been half-filled with Campbell's vegetable soup. I only became aware of this after the guy next to me took a long swallow from the helmet I'd passed to him, and still I did not throw up. Out in British Columbia, the province deploys its own smoke jumpers, also known as parrot attack crews. Ontario doesn't use smoke jumpers, but does use what it calls fire rangers, who are specially trained firefighters who don't jump from fixed-winged aircraft with parachutes, but are flown to remote fires by helicopters. As we reinvent ways to which we fight wildfires here, teams of smoke jumpers might be an option. Careful with the parachutes, heavy on river water, but please, pass on the Campbell's soup. Valuable fire prevention lesson to be learned. Regarding fire prevention, Niagara Letters in June 24th. In June, I wrote about my experience as a Niagara Falls older adult fire chief for a day. This past week, I had the fire department at my house when our smoke alarms were activated and could not be hushed. It turned out the basement alarm had malfunctioned and required replacement. We were shocked to be told, however, that although the alarm in the basement strobed like the others during testing and activation, it was only a smoke alarm and not a combined smoke carbon monoxide alarm, notwithstanding that it looks identical to the others in the house. The small print on the back of the alarm reads, not a CO alarm, but can transmit an interconnected CO alarm signal. In other words, the alarm located 20 feet from our gas furnace would activate if the other CO alarms go off, but was not capable of actually detecting or activating for carbon monoxide's presence. My valuable lesson to share, thankfully taken from a malfunction rather than a tragic scenario, is to check your alarms carefully, particularly if they were installed several years ago before your ownership or by a builder, to ensure they all detect both smoke and carbon monoxide on all levels, even if they are interconnected and appear to be the same. Thank you to the Niagara Falls Fire Department for its dedication and unwavering commitment to keeping us safe. Beth White, Niagara Falls. Let's halt large infill projects. Regarding the flooded basement's St. Geneva Street infill apartment proposal, August 13th. St. Catharines City Council and planning staff need to put a stop to infill construction for any new major large multi-unit apartment buildings that have not, as of today, started construction. Canada is a big country, and for environmental purposes, we don't need to be living in a crowded condition on top of each other with limited aging infrastructure. Another good example in this newspaper is the proposed four-tower development, rising 28 to 48 stories with more than 1,900 apartments planned for the site of the former YMCA building. This is an excellent, unsustainable example. Also, the city's Committee of Adjustment approved a reduction in the number of parking spaces required for the YMCA development. This complex is located on a small site where the abandoned Walker Family YMCA building is still located. The good news is the city has been investigating taking this property back for use for recreational purposes. But this overall problem is something City Council should really consider as a potentially serious environmental issue before approving massive infill construction complexes with our climate changing the world. Letters welcome. Send them to letters@niagaradailies.com or mail to Post Office Box 5031, STN Main Street, St. Catharines, Ontario, L2R7T4. Letters should be 250 words or less and may be edited for length and clarity. Please include your name, address, and phone number for verification purposes. Canada is changing how it issues tornado warnings. Weather alerts will move faster, be more accurate. Article by Dave Johnson, a Welland-based reporter with the Welland Tribune. Canadians will get faster, more targeted warnings for severe thunderstorms and tornadoes as Environment and Climate Change Canada overhauls how it alerts people in the path of dangerous storms. Last week, the federal agency announced its forecasters will draw custom polygons, a geometric shape outlining areas on a weather map, around targeted areas to issue more precise warnings. A news release said the new format's semi-automated text generation enables forecasters to produce storm information simultaneously in both English and French, allowing thunderstorm and related severe warnings to be issued faster. The release also said multiple warning polygrams can be in effect in the same area at the same time, overlapping one another. It gives forecasters the flexibility to track different threats and target safety information accordingly. These changes apply to severe thunderstorm and tornado warnings only. Other weather alerts, like heat warnings or severe thunderstorm watches, continue to be issued according to predetermined alert zones, the release said. The improvements are expected to reduce the number of alert-ready messages mobile users receive on their phones. Improving services. Environment, Climate Change, and Nature Minister Julie DeBruzan said precise and timely summer storm warnings help keep communities safe when facing dangerous weather. She also said Environment Canada is continuously working to improve its services. Last November, the agency introduced color-coded weather alerts utilizing a color matrix. It combines atmospheric data, such as weather models, real-time observations, and forecast confidence, with impact guides to describe potential effects on communities. Every alert type for events like wind, snow squalls, and thunderstorms now feature a specific color. Yellow for localized hazardous weather with moderate impacts. Orange for widespread severe weather causing significant disruption. And rare red alerts for extreme life-threatening events with extensive consequences. Additionally, weather phenomena that do not meet full warning criteria are denoted in gray on maps and forecasts. People can find forecasts and severe weather alerts at canada.ca/weather or download the WeatherCan mobile app on Android and ISO devices. Recent tornadoes in Niagara. A storm system that triggered tornado warnings in Niagara on August 2nd, was confirmed to have produced a downburst, but not as a tornado, after ground and drone surveys found a trail of downed trees and utility lines stretching more than 10 kilometers across Pelham and Thorold. A downburst is a powerful downward rush of cold air that can cause damage when it hits the ground. Researchers with Western University's Northern Tornadoes Project, NTP, classified the Niagara event as an EFO downburst, with an estimated maximum wind speed of 90 kilometers an hour, after reviewing radar images and public reports following the storm. They said there were no injuries. NTP researchers said the worst damage in Niagara was in the Holland and Cottmire Road areas of Thorold. Video posted on Facebook showed a downed fence and tree limbs down as a resident used a chainsaw in the background to clean up the mess. In August of 2024, NTP researchers confirmed at least one tornado caused damage in Fort Erie. They said there might have been multiple tornadoes in eastern Niagara based on witness video, photos, and reports. In Port Colborne's rural East End, a barn partially collapsed on a Brookfield Road property, while two other buildings collapsed. A small debris field was located east of the structures. Fort Erie was particularly hard hit by the storm, with damage in Stevensville on Garrison Road and as far east as the Peacebridge area. Most of the roof of a building at the back of the Rona store on Garrison Road was ripped off in the storm, with the majority landing in the backyard of a Sims Avenue home and smaller debris in a neighboring property. A month later, researchers confirmed a tornado had touched down in Niagara Falls, with video and photo evidence, supported by radar, showing a supercell storm moved southeast through the area. A preliminary EFO rating was assigned to the storm, based on a downed branches and missing shingles. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Westcott Vineyards remains true to its core values. Winery has benefited from province's U.S. alcohol ban at LCBO stores. Article by Kevin Werner. When you walk about Westcott Vineyards in Jordan Station, located on the Niagara Escarpment, there are about 16 hectares of grape rambling into the horizon. But there is also a restored barn that serves as the winery's home, and behind is a forest of native trees flourishing along 18 Mile Creek, all the way to 8th Avenue. Nearby is a meadow filled with pollinator flowers, including milkweed to attract the endangered monarch butterfly. And near the rustic outdoor patio, a garden is in full bloom, has been lovingly tended to by Carolyn Hurst, the winery's co-owner. "These are the things that I'm passionate about," said Hurst in a recent interview. "I've always been a gardener. Some of what is grown makes its way onto plates." When Hurst isn't busy with the winery, she and her crew are busy introducing native trees and wildlife into the surrounding area. "It all comes together in our wine," she said. "That's how we manage our vineyards. There are no pesticides or herbicides used on these pristine vines, as the owners are focused on a sustainable program to grow the right kind of grapes for their premium wine. We really view ourselves as stewards of the land," said Hurst, a native of Niagara and an E.L. Crossley Secondary School graduate and star basketball player. "And why wouldn't we? These are just core values." Remaining true to their beliefs, Hurst and husband and partner Grant Westcott are successfully navigating what has been a treacherous business environment, with provincial trade barriers, COVID-19, U.S. tariffs, and the responding Buy Canadian marketing campaign. Hurst said they are gradually expanding the vineyards to meet the demand for their wine in the aftermath of Ontario Premier Doug Ford imposing a ban on U.S. alcohol. The ban had the desired effect on smaller wineries, such as Westcott, with its wine sales in 2025 doubling compared to 2024. "Current orders continue to increase," while on-site sales are up about 20%. We've hit incredible success with U.S. products off the LCBO shelves, said Hurst. We really appreciate what the LCBO has done. She applauds LCBO for recognizing Ontario wines, especially smaller premium labels, as viable options for their customers. And she joins with other wineries in thanking the provinces for finally moving toward eliminating the intra-provincial trade barriers to allow for sales of alcohol between provinces. It's a no-brainer, said Hurst. It's long overdue. It makes so much sense. Since they took the plunge into the difficult wine industry in 2008, moving from Toronto in jobs in banking and technology to Niagara, they had a goal of simply growing grapes for small local wineries. But Hurst said they discovered there was no small established premium or virtual winery eager to buy their grapes. There was no one out there with a premium small winery, said Hurst. So you start to figure things out. They decided that maybe they should forge ahead and create that perfect boutique winery. Hurst said they looked to Hidden Bench Estate Winery, Le Clos Jourdain Vineyards, and Malivore Wine Company as models for their own winery at 3180 17th Street. We wanted to show that Niagara could do great things with premium-sized wine, said Hurst. We don't aspire to be a large winery. We are quite happy to be who we are. In 2012, they produced their own vintage, making the wine in their equipment barn while working through arduous process of securing coveted permits for a winery building. Construction began on the winery structure, rehabilitating a 200-year-old timber frame barn. In July 2014, they opened their tasting room. In 2018, the Westcotts acquired Butler's Grant Vineyard, a prestigious site on the 20-mile bench. It had about 20 hectares and has been expanded to include another 10 hectares, said Hurst. It was pretty bad when we took it over, said Hurst, but we did what we always do, and that was to rehabilitate the property. We also increased the acres under vine. Westcott Vineyards produces about a couple of tons of grapes per acre, a small amount compared to what commercial wineries make. Under the watchful eye of Carolyn's son, Garrett Westcott, they sell about 6,000 to 7,000 cases of wine annually. This is the wine we want to make, said Hurst. I don't think we can make it work commercially. Still, the recent success has forced them to expand, investing in their wine production, creating not only Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs, but also Rieslings, Gamay, and Cabernet Franc. We do need more space and more capacity, said Hurst. All of our funds are being reinvested into the winery. As some Niagara wineries are being taken over by corporate businesses, are put up for sale, or are seeking a different economic model to succeed, Westcott Winery is simply doing it the old-fashioned way, focusing on unique premium vintage wines that people love. Customers are discovering us, and that is a good trend to see, said Hurst. We are cautiously optimistic about our business here. We know there is no easy sailing in wine. Carolyn Hurst, co-owner of Westcott Vineyards in Jordan, says remaining true to the company's core substantial beliefs to being stewards of the land has helped to create award-winning wines and a successful business. Third set of remains found at Smith's Falls property. All three had been reported as missing persons. Article by Taylor Clark. Smith's Falls Provincial Police say they have uncovered a third set of human remains belonging to a missing person at a property southwest of Ottawa. The Ontario Provincial Police have identified the deceased as Lawrence Bertram, a Smith Falls resident who went missing nearly 4 years ago. The remains were located August 6 at a 40-acre rural property in Montague near Smith's Falls. that has been the focus of an ongoing OPP investigation since October of 2025. Investigators identified the deceased following an autopsy examination. No cause of death has been determined. Bertram, who was 42 years old at the time, was last seen leaving a residence in downtown Smiths Falls on foot on September 30th of 2022, according to the initial report from Smiths Falls Police. The discovery of his remains follows years of multi-jurisdictional investigation, including a $50,000 reward announced in March of 2025 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of anyone responsible for Bertram's disappearance. Bertram's remains are the third set found at the Kelly Jordan Road property in less than a year. The remains of Robbie Thompson, another Smiths Falls man who was reported missing in October of 23, were found after OPP executed a search warrant on the property on August 30th of 2025. A second set of remains was located on July 20th and later identified on August 5th as Robert Lambert, 75-year-old who co-owned the Montague property with one of the suspects in Thompson's case. Lambert was first reported missing on November 30th of 2018, having last been seen in early July of that year. The cause of his death is yet to be determined. Four individuals have been arrested and charged in connection with Thomas's death. One was released on bail last month. No charges have been laid in either Lambert's or Bertram's deaths. The investigation remains active, as being led by the Lanark OPP and the Smiths Falls Police Service under the direction of the OPP Criminal Investigative Branch. Locating Lawrence Bertram is a significant development for his family, who have waited nearly 4 years for answers, and for the investigative team, who have worked relentlessly on this case, said Detective Inspector Jennifer Patton with the Criminal Investigative Branch. While this discovery marks important progress, the investigation is far from complete. We understand the public interest generated by the discovery of three missing persons on a single property, and we ask for patience as investigators continue to follow the evidence wherever it leads, she added. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 20th, 2026 issue of the Niagara Falls Review. We read from the Niagara Falls Review every Saturday at 7 p.m. Your reader has been Bruce. Thank you for listening, and as always, make it a great day.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service is Off Duty. At 9 o'clock, Sports Illustrated at 9 o'clock is The Athletic from the New York Times. Stay with us for these readings and more. You're listening to your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings of newspapers, magazines, and books. For nearly 40 years, radio reading has served people who are blind or have a print disability throughout Western New York and Southern Ontario's Niagara Peninsula. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service studios are located at 1199 Harlem Road. Please spread the word about your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. For more information, call 716-821-5555. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability.